Welcome to a weekly review of North Dakota's legislative news. Now, here's your host, Dave Thompson, with North Dakota Legislative Review.
And welcome to North Dakota Legislative Review. I'm Dave Thompson. Thanks for joining us. This week, the Senate approved an expanded Board of Higher Education. This is part of the idea that you need to do some reform in the way the board works in higher education. This proposal expands the board from 8 members to 15 members. Now, if the House approves, this would be on the ballot in 2020. Also, there's a lot of talk about the upcoming revenue forecast. Monday and Tuesday, legislators will hear the new revenue forecast, and many of the legislators we've talked to are pretty optimistic that it will be at least flat and maybe a little bit more revenue than they expected. Legislative leaders and the Appropriations Committee say they'll probably split the difference between the two forecasts. One's coming from Moody's, the other one is coming from IHS Market. The IHS Market was hired by the legislature to do that review. And also, the House killed that mandatory seatbelt law. Right now, it's a secondary offense, not wearing your seatbelt. You have to be pulled over for something else. This would have made not wearing your seatbelt a primary offense. Opponents on the House floor said it was an erosion of individual rights. The Senate had earlier passed it on the second time around and passed it by a very narrow margin. So anyway, the governor signed his first bill this week. What it does is removes the mandatory minimum sentences from certain drug-related crimes and gives judges more flexibility for sentencing. We talked with one of the co-sponsors who told us his aims to give judges more flexibility when deciding an appropriate sentence.
There are individual circumstances. There are individual treatment programs and different kinds of things to address the problems without just incarceration, and it should be left to the discretion of the judge.
The new law is going to kick in on August 1st. New state and tribal tax agreements could be coming. Two bills this session would help tribes collect taxes on alcohol and tobacco. Our political correspondent, Chad Mira, caught up with the chairman of the Senate Finance and Taxation Committee.
Joining me now is Senator Dwight Cook. Senator, thanks for your time today.
You bet, Chad.
You have a couple bills you've been working on in the Senate that have to do with state and tribal tax agreements, specifically related to alcohol and tobacco taxes, as well as some sales taxes. Tell us what these bills aim to accomplish.
Well, first off, these bills are a result of the Tribal Tax Committee that we had during the last interim. And during that committee hearings that we had, tribes showed interest in imposing alcohol taxes, cigarette taxes. Only the tribes can impose taxes on their people. So these were just introduced to enable the tribe to enter into agreement with the state so that we would collect taxes imposed by the tribe.
Now, how would this benefit the tribes moving forward? They'd be able to collect to share those taxes themselves?
Yes, they'd be able to share. We'd share the revenue with the tribe based on the percentage of population that that particular tribe had to the state's population.
So right now, how is that different from the system that's in place right now?
Right now, none of the tribes impose alcohol tax, wholesale, or I think we've got one agreement with the tribe on cigarette taxes. So the way it is done today, we impose an alcohol tax. If you're on the tribe, if you're a non-native member, non-Indian member, then you have to collect and or pay the tax. If you're a tribal member, you don't have to. If the tribe was to impose their own tax, these non-tribal members would be dual taxed unless we, the state, would collect it.
So it could help generate some revenue for the tribes. Would it have any kind of fiscal impact on the state?
No, I don't think it would have any fiscal impact on the state. It would help collect revenue for the tribes, and it would guarantee that we wouldn't have any dual taxation. Nobody likes dual taxation.
Okay. Senator Cook, thanks for your time.
You bet. Thank you.
And we're now joined by State Representative Shannon Roars-Jones. She's a Republican from Fargo. Thank you for taking the time today.
Thank you for having me.
You are the caucus chair?
I am the majority caucus chair.
Tell me what the job of a caucus chair is.
Well, it's a lot of organization. What I end up doing, as far as kind of communicating to the caucus members, organizing our caucus meetings, and a lot of things related to fundraising and scheduling of events.
Now, of course, you've got your own legislation, and one of the big things that was discussed in committee this week, of course, was the Sunday opening bill.
Yes, that was just this week. We had the hearing for the Sunday opening or repeal of the blue laws. That's House Bill 1097. The hearing, I would say, it went well. It was brief. I think this is one of those topics that we've covered before in past legislative sessions. And so we don't have to spend as much time explaining things to people. It's really a matter of talking to people individually, to kind of find out who's in favor of it, and in my case, finding out who's going to be voting against it, so I can talk to them and see why and try and encourage them to vote in favor of the repeal.
First off, give me your best argument to pass the bill.
My best argument is this is not the state's role. The state of North Dakota should not be telling businesses or individuals when they should be open or closed, or when they should work or should not work. A lot of the arguments that we hear about this is that this is to protect family time, to make sure that employees have the right to go to church when they want to go to church. But what we are really protecting here is a very limited sliver of our population, retail employees, and we're not even protecting them from working, because many retail employees do work before noon on Sundays. What we're protecting the businesses is from having to be open and selling products. And so I think that generally the idea is the state of North Dakota should not be telling some businesses that you cannot be open or you cannot sell certain products between midnight and noon on Sundays. Each business should be free to make that decision for themselves and make the decisions that are best for their business and their employees.
The bill passed the House. It wasn't easy by any stretch of the imagination.
It was easier than it was the last legislative session, but yes, I mean, it's always kind of a contentious issue.
Now, the Senate was where it bogged down 2 years ago.
That's true.
But Senator Wardner, who was a no vote at the time, said on this program early on that he thought the horse has left the barn, and he thought that probably he'll vote for it. What's your count? Do you have a count about or gauge the support in the Senate?
Yeah. I do have a count right now. My count is not as optimistic as Senator Wardner's right now. I'm only at 23 yeses, and so I'm working hard to get people to reach out to their senators to make sure that their senators know how they truly feel about this bill. I have talked to Senator Wardner because I heard the comments that he made on this program, and I was very optimistic about that. He's not yet ready to give me his firm yes, but I think we're getting close. If we could get a couple more yeses, we need 24 to pass, unless there's someone who should happen to be absent. We need 24 to pass, and so I'm really working hard to get a few more votes so that we can have a little bit of a margin of error.
And I'm sure the opponents, as you mentioned, are using the same type of arguments.
I would think.
Family time, church time, set aside Sundays. But I go back to the days when they actually opened stores on Sunday, and it was kind of a process where it was grocery stores first. They increased the number of employees that could work in grocery stores. Then they said grocery stores could open, and now they are open, a lot of them 24 hours. Mm-hmm. And now you've got the retailers opening at noon on Sundays, and now the next step would be to just remove that roadblock.
Correct. And one of the important things that I think a lot of people don't recognize is because grocery stores and gas stations and truck stops can be open, and they're selling so many more products than they ever were before, that it's really treating those businesses more preferentially than we would treat, say, a Target or a Family Dollar or a local store that sells goods like that, because grocery stores are not technically supposed to be selling things like clothing or linens or pots and pans, but they do, and no one is prosecuting them for that which is technically breaking the law. It would be a Class B misdemeanor. No one is prosecuting those businesses for selling those items, but yet we're not allowing other businesses to be open and selling those same things.
Let me go to another subject. It was something that you were shepherding through too, and that was after the defeat of the recreational marijuana. You said that you were going to introduce, and you did introduce, a bill that would decriminalize the possession of small amounts of marijuana. It didn't fare that well in the House, but at the time you said there might be an opportunity to bring it back. So let me just ask about what motivated you to decriminalize.
Absolutely. During the conversations related to Measure 3, which would have legalized marijuana, not only legalized marijuana, but it would have expunged all criminal records related to marijuana and allowed really unlimited possession, unlimited opportunities for selling and growing amongst individuals, even not even through a retail establishment. That measure was really, in my estimation, a moonshot for the proponents to see if they could get everything they ever wanted. Before that measure came to be something that we were talking about publicly, I was working on legislation that would allow a process for sealing of criminal records. And it's not limited only to drug-related crimes. It's related to other nonviolent, non-sex offense crimes. And so that would create a process for someone who has made mistakes in the past but has had a period of time where they haven't had any new infractions or new issues with law enforcement, 3 years after a misdemeanor, 5 years after a felony, where they could go and have make a request of the courts to have that record sealed. That one has been somewhat successful, but during the process of Measure 3, we also, a colleague of mine who is in the criminal defense industry and I started talking about decriminalization as an alternative to full legalization. There's a lot of people that I talked to who said, I don't use marijuana, I don't intend to use marijuana, but I'm going to vote for Measure 3 because I'm tired of people having their lives ruined with the criminal records from a small amount of marijuana. That's what brought forward the idea of decriminalization. We said, why don't we take small quantities of marijuana and make it a fine-only, non-criminal offense? And that's what we started with. We started with a $200 fine for quantities of 1 ounce or less, plants, two plants or less, and that's what we were working on getting through the House of Representatives. Unfortunately, just before crossover, we had the vote on that, and it was unsuccessful by a very small margin. And so now we are working on options, alternative options. Just this last week, I had a hearing in the Senate on one of my other bills related to changes that we're doing for the Department of Corrections and their ability to release inmates who are charged with drug paraphernalia charges to treatment. And so Senator Dianne Larson put an amendment on that bill that would allow kind of a baby step towards what I was trying to do with regard to decriminalization. Her amendment allows for a $500 fine for first-time infractions of a half ounce or less. It doesn't allow anything for possession of plants. And then the second offense would be an infraction, which is the lowest level criminal offense. The third offense would be a B misdemeanor, which is what we currently charge for any sort of low-level marijuana possession right now. So it's a step in the right direction. I'm still hopeful that we may have some other options for taking a slightly larger step, but I'm happy to have that first step underway.
But the thing is, you had a vehicle.
Correct.
And it does pass the germaneness test.
Correct. It is related to the original bill, and so it's an amendment that we can kind of fold into a bill like that.
But of course, you've got some time left in the session. This is only, the 40th day so far. So.
I'm glad you know that.
Yeah. and we know that things can happen up until the gavel falls.
Exactly. Yep. So I'm always still looking for opportunities to work things in to make it a little better or a little closer to what we originally have. But of course, we also need to make sure that we have something that's going to pass.
Well, to expand this, because you've been involved, very, very intimately involved with this whole idea of justice reinvention in North Dakota. Mm-hmm. So this is probably one step in that.
It absolutely is one step in this. And there are some other bills that I've worked on that would allow for people who are participating in the 24/7 sobriety program to have access to temporary restricted driver's license so that they can work and they can be productive in the community and they can get to their daily, their sobriety testing that they need to do without having to rely on other people to drive them or to call cabs, things like that. There's also a bill that I have related to drug court, which is really allows, it's an incentive for people to really dig in and participate in the drug court program because that has, it's been described by people who work in the drug court process as probation on steroids. It's a year-long, highly intensive process that involves monitoring for drug and alcohol use. It involves check-ins at least weekly, if not more often, with probation and court staff. It involves curfews. It involves making sure that you are employed and paying back your court fines. There's a whole very detailed process that is involved in drug court participation, and it takes at least a year. So what we've proposed is allowing people who engage in and are successful completers of that drug court process to have a sentence reduction at the end of that process. It allows someone who is currently charged with a felony to have that reduced to a misdemeanor, and someone who's charged with a misdemeanor to essentially have a deferred imposition where that would be, that sentence would go away and would not show on their records if they complete that program.
And there seems to be an appetite to do something like that.
It was well received in the House, and the Senate hearing, I think, went very well also. And now I apologize. I can't remember if the Senate passed that one out yet or not.
I believe it did.
Okay.
I seem to recall that this week.
Perfect. Yeah. I think the response was good, but I didn't recall if there was a recommendation or not.
What do you think should be a next step in doing justice reinvention?
You know, I think we're going to have a couple years to monitor the changes that are made to see if they are useful, if they're effective, first of all, and then make sure that we haven't taken too large of a step if we have to roll anything back, or maybe the next step would be just to take some of those things and expand them so that they're available for a few more people. I would really like to see more drug courts open up across the state. Right now in North Dakota, we have five. One in Grand Forks, two in Fargo, one in Bismarck, and one in Minot. And I think that there was a lot of conversations during our testimony about getting access to the rural locations. It's a little bit of a careful or a tricky balance where you have to have the right mix of people. You have to have court staff who are willing to volunteer their time, which includes the judge, the state's attorney, the prosecuting attorney. You also probation officers. And then you have to have the mental health and behavioral health people who are all working together and partnering together because they all communicate and interact with one another and the people who are participating in drug court. So I would like to see some opportunities to get this pushed out into the rural communities, but the logistics are a challenge.
And therein lies why this is not existing in a vacuum. You mentioned behavioral health, and you know, anecdotally, you heard judges, especially in Western North Dakota, were sentencing people to jail because that's where they could get the treatment, because treatment's not available in Western North Dakota. I suppose part of this whole thing might be getting treatment to people out in the West River Country, and that's a workforce issue too. And it's all kind of melded together.
Absolutely. Now, I have a little bit less experience on the behavioral health and the mental health side of things, but I know that we are working. I also work with a couple of nonprofits that are developing some virtual communications programs for offering addiction counseling services to people, through like a FaceTime, a kind of an over-the-phone, over-the-air application. And I know that Department of Human Services has been working with those groups to try and get that implemented so that the state can partner with these nonprofit groups to get access to those resources out to the rural communities.
Another side issue with this whole thing was Governor Burgum's proposal to move the women out of the New England facility to Bismarck, Mandan, to the MRCC, move the MRCC people to Jamestown, build a new state hospital, and then expand the prison there. That isn't seem to have a lot of traction right now. Is that your opinion?
I would say that in the legislature, the issue has struggled, and I understand why it's struggling. Obviously, that is a big factor for that community, and they're lobbying hard for their legislators and the legislators that even don't represent them directly to make sure that we're not moving those resources or that economic impact out of their neighborhood. But I understand the reason the governor wants it as well, because it's the population that's being served out there is certainly not best suited in New England, North Dakota. These women oftentimes have high-risk pregnancies. They need to be closer to the medical attention that they require. They also have families, and oftentimes have families, and the ability for their families to visit them has a huge impact on not only their success, their successful rehabilitation, but also the success of their children. We talk a lot, or we're learning every day more about adverse childhood experiences and how those can those kind of adverse experiences that you have, whether it's the loss of a parent, whether it's abuse, whether it's having a parent incarcerated, how that can continue to affect your successfulness throughout the rest of your life.
We have a short time left. I wanted to get to this question because judiciary, I think, looked at some of these measures to limit or to put some different limits on constitutional initiated measures and other initiated measures. Where do you come down on that?
You know, we had some of those bills. It was kind of a unique situation. We had a number of different both bills and resolutions that would change the initiated measure process. Some of the resolutions and bills dealt with statutory changes, some dealt with constitutional changes. There's a number of different things. And so it's hard to really answer that question well unless I know which one you're talking about. But I do think it's a challenge, right? We've had a number of initiated measures here recently that are poorly worded, or they don't do what the proponents really want them to do. And so we want to make sure that when we have an initiated measure that passes, that it's worded well. But we certainly don't want to take that power away from the people, their right to initiate measures at all. So I think it'll be a careful balance to see what kind of maybe a modeling or a conglomeration of all of these measures or bills or resolutions that we end up with.
Yeah, but there's been an effort to just put a few more limits on them.
Right. There definitely has been, and there's everything from one that I know of that has gotten a lot of pushback is the require for the legislature to ratify something that passes. I think that's less likely to be successful, but different options that open up access to legislative counsel for drafting assistance, I think, is much more palatable, both in the legislature and for the people who want to pursue initiated measures in the future.
Well, I thank you for being here.
Thank you for the time. I appreciate
it. Is State Representative Shannon Rose Jones of Fargo. She's a Republican representative. How some students are dressed at graduation this year could look a little bit different. If House Bill 1335 passes the Senate, Native American students at every school will be allowed to wear eagle feathers or plumes. Political correspondent Chad Mira tells us how certain dress codes have sparked a bipartisan effort.
Sheridan McNeil's son will graduate from high school this spring.
It's going to be a very emotional time. He's my youngest one.
An emotional time that will be marked with a sacred symbol.
He'll be wearing his dad's feather along with he'll be given another feather for his accomplishments.
Native Americans are honored with eagle feathers and plumes at significant moments in their lives. That includes Indian Affairs Commission Executive Director Scott Davis.
When I graduated from high school, college, got married, done some things in my career, an elder was gave a feather to me, and that's a big deal.
But some students in North Dakota can't display them at graduation.
Every April, May, I've gotten calls.
Calls from families unhappy that their school's dress code policies prohibit the feathers.
That would almost be like, us saying to anyone, that's a Christian that you can't wear a cross.
That's been a long-standing custom in our Native American and Native country for years, for decades.
House Bill 1335 would prohibit schools from banning objects of cultural significance. It passed the House with a 90-2 vote and has the support of the state superintendent.
The understanding and respect, I think I can't say enough how that's transitioned through the first half and now, crossover. So that I'm very, very thankful for that.
McNeil is thankful her son's school already allows the feathers.
I just couldn't imagine him not being able to wear something that is so significant to our culture.
In the spring, everyone might be able to display them proudly.
Chad Mira Jones is now to talk about the week ahead. And yeah. I think we're both focusing on something
big
that's
going
to happen early in the week.
That's right. On 2 days, two separate March revenue forecasts coming in, and this is really going to have a big impact on the rest of the session. A lot of people looking at how much money we have to spend. This could have a big impact on the Teddy Roosevelt Presidential Library. This could have an impact on things like state employee raises and also some of the behavioral health issues that you were just talking about with Representative Rose Jones.
Yeah, I'm still hearing from legislators, I'm sure you are too, that there at least is some cautious optimism that things will probably tick up a little bit in terms of revenue.
Right. I've been hearing that a lot too from just about everyone I've talked to. They seem very optimistic about this March revenue forecast. The last forecast they got was just before the session began, right at the beginning, December, January, and it was intentionally done on the conservative side. Lawmakers didn't want to be too optimistic right from the start because they didn't want to be passing bills and considering things that they didn't think they'd necessarily have the funds to do. So they went a little conservative from the beginning. They think this one will be maybe a little bit higher than what they were working with to begin the session.
Another thing that's probably dependent at least somewhat on the revenue forecast is the Prairie Dog infrastructure bill. Mm-hmm. And it did clear the Senate Finance and Taxation Committee and should be in appropriations probably next week as well.
Yeah, it's been moving very quickly, actually. So we'll have to keep an eye out, see if that continues to move forward.
I think the plan was to fast track it and to get it out, get it to the governor. And the governor's had some reservations about it, but maybe the new revenue forecast might assuage some of those.
It could. It very well could. And you know, another thing, when I talk to some lawmakers, they say this is very important for behavioral health services. You're talking about getting some services in, all around the state, not just focus in certain areas. Well, we're going to start to learn, I think, you know, what the true priorities are, what the highest priorities are in this session, because, you know, we can't necessarily afford everything, and this forecast will give us a good idea of what we can fund and what might have to wait till a little farther down the road.
It truly is a giant jigsaw puzzle. Mm-hmm. You have to make sure the pieces all fit, and now the forecasts will help them make those pieces fit.
Absolutely.
I get the feeling that, you know, state employee raises is one of the top priorities.
It is, and they've been talking about this since the very beginning. It looks like the Senate believes, I talked to Senate Majority Leader Rich Warner, he thinks once the forecast comes in, they can give a 2% raise the first year and then a 3% raise the second year. Some lawmakers, especially on the House side, are saying, well, if this is a good forecast, we might be able to even give 3% each year. So that's another thing that they all are in agreement. The state employees need a raise. We're going to see where the numbers fall here.
And, of course, everything else also depends on that, too. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else that you might be looking at?
Well, I think real quickly, because we're running out of time, but something we've been following, obviously, is the Board of Higher Education. The expanded single board idea has passed the Senate. That'll go back to the House, where we know earlier in the session a two-board system
didn't
failed.
Didn't fare very well, exactly.
So we'll see if they like the expanded single board.
All right. Chad, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. I am Dave Thompson. Thanks for joining us for North Dakota Legislative Review.